Today's show is sponsored by Miracle Made. And oh my God, you guys, you know that I love a luxurious set of sheets. And I now have such a set of sheets because of a Miracle Made. They are bedding that has been inspired by NASA. They've got silver-infused fabrics that actually make temperature regulating a thing. So you're not like getting too hot or too cold or whatever, you know, the whole thing that happens with your body's temperature losing its mind. Miracle Made helps with that. One of the little things that my husband particularly loves about Miracle Made is that it like doesn't have as much bacteria as regular sheets because of it's infused with this silver that prevents up to 99.7% of bacterial growth. So it leaves the sheets cleaner for longer. And then the thing for my husband is that it doesn't give him acne, which is like an issue for some people. But more than all of that, it's just luxuriously comfortable and delightful. And it has that cooling feeling while also being cozy. Very hard to achieve those two things at the same time. I mean, Miracle Made, come on, well done. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and buy some sheets today. And if you order today, you can save 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION at the checkout and you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. So there's just a lot of savings here, folks. Order today, you'll get 40% off. Use the promo code FAKETHENATION. Go to trymiracle.com/FAKETHENATION. And Miracle's so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you're not 100% satisfied, which I don't see happening, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/fakethenation and use the code FAKETHENATION to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/fakethenation to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode.
Fake the Nation, episode 164.
The acoustics in the room were, I think, in a weird way, delayed or something like that. I couldn't, like, I
had the same
experience.
Didn't give
any pauses because I was just like, I'm not immediately hearing a laugh, but then sometimes I would hear it like a little later. So it was like maybe traveling to the stage at a weird.
You were terrific.
But no, thank you. It was really fun.
One.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we like to monitor natural disasters from the ninth hole. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and I get that presidents take time off, but I really prefer when they're just less obvious about it, and I prefer it when they have a White House dog. I'll just say that for the record. And I prefer it when they have some sort of a moral fiber. Those are just a couple of things I prefer. But anyways, today we're going to talk about CNN's unprecedented 6-hour-long climate change town hall and how the primary candidates plan on low-key saving the earth. And we'll also talk about whether removing the gifted and talented programs are a viable way of desegregating schools. And finally, Woodstock, it's the 50th anniversary. How did it define a generation? I'm so excited by today's panel, you guys. Because, and I know I say that probably every week, but the reason I say it is because I'm in a position of maniacal power only in this podcast and kind of second to Harry. But in my second banana power position, I get to bring on people that I think are fucking funny and fun and amazing. So that's why I get to say that statement every week and then actually mean it. So, oh my God. For the first time on the show, definitely not the last, you've seen her on HBO and on Comedy Central. She has an album out called So You Just Out Here. She's so incredibly funny. You guys, it's Shalewa Sharp. Hey, Shalewa.
Hello.
And veteran to the show. He's been here many times. You know him very well. He has a daily show on Sirius XM, on the Insight Channel. He's been on everything. Oh, he's dear. Performed everywhere. Mm. He's headlined all over
everything.
The country. He's
run literally. You can see my toxicology reports. I have been on everything.
And he's currently headlining the Laughing Liberally show off Broadway in New York City,
which is Nagin Farsad performed on last night.
And I'm doing again in a couple of weeks. So it's running until September 21st. It's so great. The lineups are ridiculous. And then headlining, you've got your man, John Fugelsang.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, my God. Thanks, you guys, for being on the show. Did you have good Labor Day weekends? Was that celebrated at all? Did you just work through it?
I went to a wedding that was very elaborate because it was for a couple that was younger than me, so they were full of love and hope. and it was adorable to see. So I had to travel to see it. It was my first Jewish wedding.
Oh.
And I was friends with the groom, who's a comic, who's about, 6'4". So I really went just to see him be lifted in a chair.
was it traumatizing? Because I get scared when non-6'4 people get lifted in a chair.
It was a little terrifying. They seemed to be having a blast.
I saw a 6-month pregnant Jewish woman also. Hey, what about the order in which those things happened? But 6 months pregnant, she was huge, and they lifted her in the chair, and the audience was just like schwitzing the whole time. Oh my God, when is this going to be over? She handled it like a pro.
I think that the joy level so high in that room at that point,
yeah,
that it's pure adrenaline,
totally,
just launching these people up into the sky. I never feel that level of joy. So I was just on the outskirts like, man, I hope they can do it. Oh, I'm cheering for you.
Did you go to any weddings this Labor Day?
No, but I'm a big fan of the New York City Labor Day Parade, a parade unlike any other. No pesky helicopters of news outfits covering that parade. No noise from media giving coverage. For whatever reason, the people who own the major media don't really feel the need to advertise the work of labor. I couldn't tell you why. So it's the parade where you don't have a lot of people.
That's so true,
I mean,
John,
it's the empty.
It's so weird.
No, it's not weird. It's perfectly logical. And it's kind of sad that, labor, as Lincoln said, is the superior of capital. And capital knows it. So capital needs to downplay labor. So like every time I've gone to the parade and I take my horrible child, it's amazing to go to a parade where there's no crowds because there's no press for it.
Aww.
And not a lot of coverage. But, it's great to support the guys and to see all the men and women who are organized labor in the city come out for their day and support each other, and they're all having fun, and it's nice to see them smiling. And it was my birthday, which was nice, so I got my second grader, he just started second grade this morning, to watch his first Marx Brothers movie, which I was the best birthday present for me.
Did he love it?
Children love Harpo. It's really true.
Oh my gosh,
yeah.
Okay.
If I could suggest for the parade planners next year to take a page from the West Indian Day Parade that happens on Labor Day. Maybe some glitter.
Yeah.
Perhaps
the West Indian Day Parade
truck
is just
with speeches being played, but a bass line underneath. That may increase.
You know what? Body suits and things that are revealing, it wouldn't kill the working guys.
I mean,
No, but what the Labor Day could really use is like a Lady Gaga or a whoever.
Something.
You know what I mean? Maybe she'll do the glitter and then everyone else can just be proud of their,
And she can still
labor.
Be in a sensible outfit.
But
the glitter's really doing the heavy lifting.
Because I feel like celebrities haven't caught on to supporting labor in the same way that, they support some other causes.
Oh, you think? By celebrities, you mean everyone, right?
But I just have to say that I saw, oh my God, what's Olivia Pope's actual name?
Kerry Washington.
I saw Olivia Pope give a speech during one of the many marches of 2017.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about and she talked about being a member of a union and what that meant. And I was like, this is great. Why don't we use this woman all the time? It was truly inspiring. Anyways, I don't know. Look it up, whatever. You guys, let's get into the show with topic number one. Okay, so for reasons that defy logic, the Democratic National Committee decided not to hold a climate change debate This issue is so central to voters. It's like saying you can put out this fire, but you can't use water, or like we do have a scheduled orgy, but no touching. You know what I mean? Like, it's like that. Doesn't make sense. But CNN and MSNBC found a loophole in the DNC rules last night, and CNN did a monster six-hour marathon town hall on climate change. MSNBC is going to do one a few weeks' time. Each of 10 candidates got 35 minutes to prove they know at least as much as Jay Inslee. So what do you guys think, first of all, by the DNC rules and that CNN and MSNBC are conducting these town halls?
What? Oh, wait, what do we think about the rules?
Just like, yeah, why do you think about, why didn't they just have an actual debate? Like, right.
I don't think they think it's that big of a deal. Do you know what I mean? Like,
if the Democrats don't think it's a big of, you know, a big deal, then
yeah,
who fucking thinks it's a big deal?
That's a big part of the problem. But I feel like they know it's a deal.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's still the mindset of, look, man, we just got to whittle this down so that we can beat old dude.
Right.
And so until they're told otherwise, even though they're being told otherwise constantly, I feel like it still feels like, yes, climate change. Yes. Yes. Sure. Yes.
I mean, right. I enjoy the debates. Before I say, are either of you Democratic candidates for president this year? I have to ask every group I'm in now. I don't want to offend anyone.
I'm still thinking about it.
I know it's a large field, so I'm just, you know.
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting was I've enjoyed the debates so far. I think they're great. I love seeing Bill de Blasio and Marianne Williamson on stage the way I loved Al Sharpton on the debate stage in 2004. Someone's here to keep me awake. Great. I actually preferred this because this was not a case where you would have 1 minute to reply to a question. This was actually designed not for hot takes, but for substantive discussion on an issue that affects all of us. They are fighting for the very right wingers who hate them and are dragging this entire town hall episode on social media right now. The debates are kind of like you tune in to see one of two camps. Who is going to have sweeping reform of a rigged economic system? And there's Senator Warren, there's Senator Sanders. Or who's going to beat the crap out of Trump in a debate? There's Kamala Harris, there's Joe Biden, there's the rest of them. This was not about Trump.
Yeah,
this was about all of us. It was about the future. And this is the time when we have to find out what is the difference in policy with all these people. They all have one thing in common. A Republican-controlled Senate won't allow them to do anything about climate change. And that's the big elephant in the room.
But, so do you think that the DNC will now go, you know what? Yeah, we do like this idea. Let's do this for other things, even though they didn't technically back.
I mean, I can see them doing it for something like guns. I can see them doing it maybe, like, you know, for a couple of sexy topics. But generally, the debates are ratings machines. And I don't mind that. Like, people say, oh, I wish we could be England and have 6 weeks of all this campaigning. That would never work here. We are not a civic people. We have an attention span like the guy from Memento. We need a year and a half just to know these people and start talking about issues. So for me, the more coverage, the better. And I applaud CNN for doing it. And honestly, the amount of difference towards a habitat that can sustain humanity ending, because the world's going to be fine.
Right.
There's going to be a lot fewer of us.
There'll still be dirt.
Well, no, I don't think
it'll just be contaminated and then it'll kill people.
I don't think climate change.
Those dinosaurs are going to be lit, right?
I don't think it's going to end humanity. I think there'll be a lot less of us. But it is really inspiring to see something that on a ratings level is not a sexy topic. No one likes talking about climate change. So to see CNN devote 7 hours of programming to this issue, I was really inspired by it. I
agree. I never, like, I'm not the kind of person that praises cable news almost ever.
Me neither.
But the fact that CNN devoted so much airtime, they've like actually done something for the electorate on this one. And I really appreciate it. And I was truly shocked by actually learning something in the way that in the debates I don't, right? I don't feel like I learn very much watching the debates. I feel like I see a test of composure in debates, right? It's not really, it's extremely performative, but it's not about substance. And in this, like Andrew Yang
Yep.
He has a bunch of ideas on climate change, and they sound really well thought out. I mean, he's a considerate guy on this issue in a way that I had no idea. Julian Castro, not as much. His answers seemed sort of like vague. Mm-hmm. Pete Buttigieg, also like kind of like more vague. Guys, can we talk about what Elizabeth Warren wants to do?
Mother of dragons.
Right. That's exactly
saying. Is this a Game of Thrones? We didn't
actually,
just
it is,
stumble
yes.
into a Game of Thrones thing, did we?
Yeah, but I think I call Kamala Harris that too.
Oh, okay.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yeah.
No, so Warren, she wants to put $3 trillion in spending over a decade to combat human-driven global warming. She wants to eliminate planet warming emissions over 10 years and add an additional trillion to subsidize that transition. She wants to pay for that by reversing the Trump tax cuts, because that's a fun thing. She actually knows how to pay for her programs. She wants to retire coal-fired electricity, but still fund pensions and healthcare for coal miners. She wants to create federal regulations on vehicle tailpipe emissions.
Job-killing regulations.
Right, and she wants to create jobs. I don't remember what this specific number was, but there's something like 1.5 million jobs will be created in the process of green manufacturing and creating incentives for companies to engage in green manufacturing here and not in other – not like outsourcing it to China or whatever. So is there a candidate that stands out to you? I've obviously tipped my hat. Warren is the one that stood out to me on the climate change issue. Is there someone that you felt like is really hitting the mark?
I like Warren for a very, not even petty, just for a very simple reason. 'Cause my brain is having a hard time taking it all in. So I read that she spoke with Inslee after he bowed out. And I was like, that's good thinking. I'm with her.
Yeah.
But yeah, like
that's a catchy slogan, right?
Yeah,
that down.
I know. She
because
should.
I'm with her.
I'm with her. Yeah. Let's do it.
Jay Inslee's plan, for those of you who don't know, has been widely lauded by environmentalists as a great plan.
Right. And I think I like that she thought to speak to him about it, but also clearly had her own ideas and that the work was to kind of integrate it and see what could actually be done within. Mm. And you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. That's the kind of thinking that's going to be necessary.
And one of the things she said in the town hall yesterday that I thought was phenomenal was she was like, you know, we have a climate change package, right, of what we want to do. But it's actually a segment of literally everything we would do in government. So if we have a trade deal with another country, the trade deal would be like, okay, how much does your product emit? What are the emissions rates of your product?
Right.
That's going to be taken into consideration when we make trade deals, for mm-hmm. example, right? So that it's a part of absolutely everything that the government does. It's not just
let's talk climate change for about 30 minutes.
Yeah.
Before I go to lunch and then go on to other things.
It is not
that.
It is every day in every aspect of what we do. What is the climate change aspect of this policy? And I think that's brilliant. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how we should be thinking about it all the time. Did anyone strike you as interesting?
All of them did.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but you have to look at how our friends on the other side respond to this. And it's all job-killing regulation. It's all just fantasy. And it's kind of hilarious because these are the folks who claim to be pro-life. And here's the deal. If you reject the overwhelming consensus of the world scientific community on climate change, you don't get to tell me you care about the unborn anymore. And I want to see the Democrats take the fight to them on this. You are not a patriot. You are not a Christian. You don't care about the unborn if you want to just keep on doing the Trump doctrine of rewarding polluters. Warren's plan does create jobs, and that is the part that has to be hammered, because you have to see what their lies are about Paris Accord, about what have you. So, you know, the best part about being a climate change denier is that you're going to be long gone by the time your grandchildren curse your name for having been one. In the meantime, you either want to make it better or you want to make it worse. And we have a pretty clear choice here of, you know, a side that is rewarding polluters, because they'll say that creates jobs. At the end of the day, there's only one real question. Does your climate plan include any kind of means or plan to blackmail Mitch McConnell with embarrassing, compromising photographs?
Right.
Because the only question is, how are you going to get the Republican Senate to cooperate in ways Barack Obama couldn't?
Yeah, what that is your political savvy
on that? I had Bernie on my show 2 weeks ago, and that was my main question. How are you going to get Mitch McConnell to come to the table in ways that President Obama couldn't?
What was his answer?
He gave a good Bernie answer.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And I love Bernie. He's great. He's, you know, Bernie on fire with a head injury and leprosy is better than Trump on his best day.
So. True. And also, Bernie has a very comprehensive plan.
Right.
His spending on it is even higher than all of the candidates.
Yeah, I think his was the highest.
Yeah, his is the highest.
And Bernie's best line was about how, you know, we're going to cut the military budget. And they said, why? He goes, because we're not going to be having wars for oil anymore. And it was one of my favorite comments of the week.
Yeah. That is a good one. That's a great one. That's
nicely
fucking
done.
Reasonable. Yeah. It's so fucking reasonable.
He said we're not going to have oil wars anymore.
I love it. Such a reasonable thing, and yet it still makes people go, oh,
right?
Reason?
Like, totally.
Yeah. Sorry.
Well,
logic.
Can I mention something that Andrew Yang has in his policy that I wanted to talk about, which is that he wants to have a fund, and a lot of people have something similar to this, a fund to relocate people that are affected by climate change. It's kind of controversial, right? This divide between rebuilding an area that has been affected by climate change versus just relocating people and recognizing that that area is maybe not fit for rebuilding. Where do you guys stand on that for people that have been in a particular land for generations? Telling them that they have to move, or that you know, that there won't be any federal assistance, rather, for them to rebuild.
I feel like many of those people won't move. Do you know what I mean? I get the idea and I get the thought behind it, but if you add the human aspect to it, I don't see where that's going to end up working out. That seems like a huge just backfire in the making.
Mm, you could have my beachfront property when you pull up my cold,
you know,
dead,
because
soggy
that's
hands.
Also going to end up affecting a lot of people who, like, I guess maybe the working poor, you know, people who are in someone in poverty, but they own their land, they own their house, and it's been in their families for generations now. Is the area perhaps terrible because these people have all been funneled into a horrible part of town? Well, yes, but it's also theirs.
Yeah.
And they've been making do for a couple of generations at this point. So now you're like, oh, it turns out that there's a little schmutz in the dirt, so we're going to have to move you. No, I don't see that going well, because then it looks like you're just forcing people out. Where are you putting them?
Right.
I mean, where?
But there's like, you know, and then there's that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the places that are sort of like moderately habitable, but
right.
Like then there's places like there's these barrier islands off of the coast of Louisiana that are just, they're underwater, so there really is no rebuilding on and those, you know, there are people that have been there for generations. There's tribes that you know, that are there, and so I think it's tough, because there are also issues of like tribal sovereignty and what do we do with you know, and Elizabeth Warren brought up, you know, them being stewards of the land, and they were for generations, and how do we you know, create a situation in which they can continue to be stewards of the land. So I mean, it's complicated, and it's hard to tell people this parcel is over.
Right. Yeah. That's the, I mean, on paper, though, I'm sure as an assignment, that is excellent. It's a great idea for sure.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Man, when you get emotions involved, it's...
My last question to you guys is this a question? Because I felt like maybe in some cases people were sort of like out progressiving each other. What do you think is going to be like the metric by which people make a determination if climate change is their number one issue? And by the way, I wrote down a couple of statistics.
That you're not Trump is the metric.
That you're not Trump is the metric. No, totally. Because a majority of registered voters nationwide, 56%, said that climate change is an emergency. That majority included 84% of Democrats. Mm. 81% of Republicans said that climate change is not an emergency. Okay. 18 to 34-year-old voters who would be most affected of that demographic, 74% said that climate change is an emergency. So the 67% of Americans in general say
right.
that more needs to be done and that America needs to be a leader. So is this something that people are going to vote on? If 67% of Americans, we should win this election is what I'm saying.
Right, yeah.
I don't even know.
For some people, it may be, it feels like an emergency, but at this point, so many things feel like an emergency that I wonder that if they really break it down more than I'm expecting will probably vote on this. But I don't know if it's going to be major enough, which is why I think working it in to all types of policy is like Warren is discussing might be the best way to even tackle it so that it's just understood that it's going to be part of the fabric of
right
of our,
but otherwise
until 20 years from now when the GOP are claiming they were always the ones at the forefront
yes
of the,
no,
the
absolutely.
Way they claimed we were always conservatives were leading the civil rights movement
no,
really
totally.
But your point is actually very apt because they like to say how divided we are as America. I don't really think we are when it comes to ideology. The majority of Americans believe science. The majority of Americans want to do something about this. The majority of Americans want the rich to pay more taxes. The majority of Americans want to decriminalize weed. The majority of Americans support a woman's right to sovereignty over her body. We're not divided. We're divided in terms of our participation on Election Day. In our civic engagement, we're divided. But America's not divided on the issues.
No.
We come down on clearly the progressive sides on just about everything. But this is not going to be an issue people vote on. People who don't care will vote for the man who doesn't care. People who do care will vote. And it's all going to come down to a few percentage points in 7 states.
Fuck the Electoral College.
Indeed. Thank you, dead slave owners.
But I really, because it feels like 2018 was the year that we started caring about women. Now let's make right? Like,
well, that comes around every 20, 25 years or so.
I want us to continue to care about the way we're like trying to add climate change to every policy. Let's continue to remember women with everything.
Sure, sure.
And then let's just add climate 2020. Let's make it the year of women and climate change. You know, that's
like everything, like abortion rights or like mass incarceration or guns. The problem in this country is so many folks who have one degree of empathy. It's got to happen to someone I know before I care.
That is true.
For a lot
if
of
it
folks,
doesn't, if they, it doesn't hit them, that's why
I don't
know if climate change, because it still feels abstract
even though
we've got
like,
a hurricane that's
like,
not moving and the Amazon is on fire. It still feels abstract.
There's not a lot of climate scientists buying beachfront property in Florida for a reason.
Right.
And, you know, it's all going to come down to, unfortunately, a lot of these folks are going to have their neighborhoods or someone they know get flooded and before they believe it. Because there's a 24-hour propaganda network telling them not to trust science.
Speaking of getting flooded, I just want to close this segment by reminding people about Hurricane Dorian and the Bahamas. Super fucked, you guys.
Extremely.
Some really, really sad and horrible stories coming out of there. You can donate to the National Association of the Bahamas Hurricane Relief Fund. Again, that's the National Association of the Bahamas Hurricane Relief Fund. Because I know the people of Fake the Nation do that kind of thing. Because you guys are great and you care. You know what we're going to do right now? We're going to take a quick break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about gifted and talented programs. Today's show is sponsored by Prose. This is kind of, I feel like, you know, I'm on some sort of Lord of the Rings journey trying to figure out skincare. And I feel like this customized skincare line is really got my name on it. Basically, every bottle of Prose custom hair care and skincare, I tried the skincare just recently, is made to order and it's personalized. It's got a unique blend of naturally powerful and proven effective ingredients to meet your needs, like specifically you. And then the way they do it is you take this great, like in-depth quiz, basically. They analyze over 80 factors for a complete view of your life, your beauty goals. Like I have oily skin that's also dry, which is just a fun little conundrum. I live in New York City. Like we've got these four seasons. My face gets weird during seasonal shifts. All of these things I got to kind of talk about in answering the questions. The other fun thing was they asked us at the end, like, do you like a creamy type of moisturizer or like a less creamy kind? And I was kind of like, I think like less creamy. And they were like, that's fine. Like you can do that. But we think for your skin type, creamier is better. And I never knew that. So I love that there's so much kind of personal information that goes into creating this. I got my stuff in the mail very quickly after. I got a wonderful serum. Like I said, this very creamy moisturizer. And this also very just delectably creamy cleanser that just kind of feel like I think it's possible that I've been washing my face with just like harshness. Like many years, because when I saw this cleanser, I was like, oh, is this what it's supposed to feel like? It's supposed to feel like a little bit of a delight on my face. That's not what I've been doing. So I don't know, guys. And here's the thing, you don't have to take my word for it. In a third party, double blind, dermatologist supervised controlled clinical study, which is like the gold standard for research studies, Prose prove that personalization works better than off-the-shelf alternatives, which just sort of totally makes sense on a just logical level. If you think about it, just it makes common sense. Prose is so confident that you'll love your results that they're offering my listeners an exclusive trial offer so you can see the difference custom care can make. 50% of your first subscription order at prose.com/fakethenation will be taken off. That's prose.com/fakethenation. You get your free consultation and 50% off your one-of-a-kind formulas. Again, that's prose.com/fakethenation. Go and get your just super personalized, luxurious skincare products and hair care products. That's what I'm going to try next. So prose.com/fakethenation. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. And we are back. You guys, and let's get into topic number two. So here's the deal with New York City. It's ridiculously diverse. The student population is mostly made up of Black and Latinx students, but the city's gifted classes are made up of about three quarters white and Asian Americans. So we have a bit of a segregation problem.
Just a smidge.
So I was reading a piece about this in the New York Times, and the opening sentence on this gifted and talented programs was this: to get into a gifted and talented elementary school program in New York City, children must ace a single high stakes exam when they are 4 years old. And I laughed out loud because I didn't realize that it was 4 year olds taking this exam.
Yep.
So de Blasio, who we know as a ill-fated presidential candidate, appointed a panel study, to study this problem. And the panel suggested that the city get rid of the program, the gifted and talented program, And the harrowing test of 4-year-olds. Guys, are they reading Tolstoy at 4? John, you have a kid. Is that what they're doing? I mean, what are they testing?
You know, it's so funny because Me Too is defined by, are we going to define someone's entire life based on the worst thing they ever did? And now, are we going to define your entire future based on your score on a test when you were 4 and didn't even realize what you were doing? And that's really what this is. Now, the most fun part about this is reading National Review and watching the pearl clutching and saying, oh no, they're getting rid of our gifted and talented programs, which are overwhelmingly tilted towards Caucasians or people of means.
Yeah.
You know, just like our testing is. And it takes people, again, a long time to decode how that really works. But
right.
It doesn't take you too long to understand why a poor kid is not necessarily going to do as well on this test as a child whose parents read to it every day. So it's deeply, deeply unfair. But it is worth pointing out, this sort of thing is the conservatives flip out. They say, okay, this is like forced busing 101 all over again. De Blasio has distanced himself from this, like the electorate has distanced itself from Bill de Blasio's presidential campaign. Keep that in mind. This is never going to happen in New York. Bill de Blasio will never do this. He had a commission. They recommended this. De Blasio has already said, no. And that's the end of it, except for the outrage. And, you know, it brings me back to busing. I think busing's great. But, you know, when Kamala Harris had her memeable moment, I'm like, so are the Democrats going to really get behind busing? Because I'd love to see that. I'd love to see them fight for it, but they won't. They've quietly walked away from it. And again, when you try to redress grievances and injustices, you get accused of identity politics.
Yeah.
When you focus on white males, no one accuses you of identity politics. And the problem we would have with this is, maybe it'll happen on the local level and some cities will try it and some cities will pull it off and have some data to show for it. It's not going to happen in New York based on this commission.
Well, it was... First off, I'm relatively new to New York in that I was born here and then my family shuttled us away quickly. And now I've been back for 6 years. So I've befriended people with children and I am very confused as to how children go to school here. Are we not just going to the school that's in the district?
No.
Why or what? What's happened? Why is that?
Right. It's so complicated.
It's extremely complicated.
And I
grew up in Atlanta. To put a finer point on it, I grew up in Stone Mountain, Georgia. And that's a huge piece of granite with Confederate Army heroes etched in the side.
Oh,
so
God.
I know from busing.
Okay.
Like they were still doing it in the 80s when I was in high school, for sure. And I just don't understand, first off, how you're sending your kids to school. Also, my understanding is New York is kind of one of the last places, if not the only place, that's still dealing with doing things this way, the
4-year-old
way.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, like the testing. My sister, when we were in high school, she went to a magnet school. It was a performing arts high school. It was not in our district, but, you know, you audition, they let you in. I think when I was maybe in fourth grade or something, they let me take a test. They were like, oh, you seem kind of smart. They stuck me in a program. And then we moved and I went to another school and they were like, oh, yeah, we don't have that. And it's like, all right, cool. I'll just keep it. You know what I mean? Like I don't understand how that's not.
Right. So I think one of the things one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this is, and you're bringing up the point, is essentially it's all over the fucking place, depending on where you are, and which kind of like highlights the fact that we need some federal standards and we don't have them, right? Because everyone—
Are we still not keeping childs behind? Are we still doing that?
Are we leaving them behind?
Or is that done?
I have no idea.
Because I had a lot of friends who were like instructors at that time.
Right.
And the stuff that they went through for all the testing and all of that kind of stuff, like, is this just the pendulum swinging the other way of like, okay, just the one test and then they seem smart enough because they knew where the test was and they knew how they had enough to pay for the things. And so we'll just send them there.
Right. I mean, the problem is with all of the tests. I mean, so some districts are testing, doing multiple tests so that not everything comes down on one test.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll test in some districts, they'll test a kindergartner, and some of them will be a first or second or third grader, right? Like I said, it's all over the place. Yeah. We don't know what the best practice is, which I think is the fucking big problem in this country. And the other, in some places, will also include in-class performance as a metric.
Yeah.
Some of them just do it based on testing. So I just want to...
By in-class performance, you mean behavior.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I just want to point out something from my own experience. So in my district, they tested us, I think we were seven or maybe second grade,
mm-hmm.
and or whatever that is. And I didn't make the cut. I didn't make the cut, and I was really upset because I wanted to be in the gifted and talented program. I was an extremely driven second grader.
Right.
And I recruited my mother, who didn't know that this was even happening, that I was tested. She didn't. She's an immigrant. She doesn't. Right. She didn't know. Right. And I said, listen, Mom, we're going to go to school. You're going to fucking get in there and you're going to fight for me because I need to be in that program. And she was just like, oh, yeah, OK, let's do it. And she went and she fought for me and they put me in the program. I think this sounds like bragging, but then I went on to be top of my class and I ended up in not one, but two Ivy League schools. They obviously, that fucking test obviously had it wrong,
right?
When it came to me. Now, for places that are doing these tests, districts that are just, that have a test or a couple of tests, how many kids like me are getting it wrong?
Exactly.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And because did the gifted and talented program and followed by the AP classes that I ended up taking and mm-hmm. all that stuff. I mean, I basically walked into college as a sophomore because I had taken so many AP classes and had taken so many of those tests that I got college credit for them, mm-hmm. you know?
I was the opposite.
It put me on a path, you know?
Yeah.
And that's because somehow as a 7-year-old, I knew that someone had to fight for me. But I don't even know why I knew that.
Well, that's your Muslim privilege in this society. I think it's pretty obvious to all of us that you walk between the raindrops. It was awkward for me because I was deemed gifted but not talented. And that was really hard to come home and tell my parents about. Sorry, you're gifted, kid, but there's no talent.
Yeah, I just took the test and told my parents, I get to go into another room during class for 30 or 45 minutes. And they were like, wait, what? what is happening? And then they asked, they're like, oh, got it. All right.
Right.
Okay.
But isn't it weird that there's this, you know, it's like the best of parents, right?
Right.
Don't understand the fucking process because it's different everywhere you go and it doesn't make sense anywhere.
What's important is to remember the rich kids still do better. And that's what matters.
Yeah,
here.
Yeah, yeah.
But
yeah,
and again, they're not, this proposal dealt with scrapping G&T, but it is worth saying that they did want to compensate for that by having magnet schools and enrichment programs that don't have any tests you need to take to get into it. But also, you know, some kids develop slower.
Right.
I've come to believe that I'm 6'2". I'm the shortest in my family. And my child is abnormally large. And I have come to believe that every child's body grows at different rates, but their nervous system grows at the same rate. So sometimes bigger kids can seem oafish and clumsy because they just haven't finished getting wired up yet.
I was
diagnosed as mentally retarded as an infant. And
really?
Yeah. My dad was an educator. My mom was a nurse. And they were told I was going to be special ed my entire life. So children are very malleable little creatures.
Yeah.
And I'm slightly better now. I mean, you should see my Special Olympics trophies. I kicked ass by the time I was 18. But, you know, children develop at different rates and they develop at different times. And there are growth spurts that don't just have to do with height.
Yeah.
So I don't think that one single test at the age of 4 is equitable or fair or even smart for a society.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. I don't. That makes no sense.
But also, I mean, you know, I have, now that I have this baby, I'm noticing these things more.
This baby.
This is like a random baby that I have. that there's testing centers geared towards 18 months old.
Yes.
Yeah. What
big
fuck?
Business. It's big business.
Yeah, yeah. And
really the test is just determining how much money do you have
to do those
classes. Oh, you've got enough to do
classes.
The classes and take this
exactly.
test. Yeah. You are so gifted.
Yeah, it's really, can you go to school on Gattaca? That's what it's all about.
And also, and it's, sometimes it's not even about money. It's about like a cultural pressure, you know, like mm-hmm. there'll be, you know, poor Chinese immigrants who will spend every last amount of disposable income, of which they have very, very little, on a class like that because mm-hmm. they are just going to, you know, make sure that their child has no fun and gets into this program, you know? And that's, I mean, you know, coming from a similarly like workhorse-driven immigrant culture that I came from, it was like, that's what you do, you mm-hmm. know? And so they're not even necessarily wealthy, but they're just still like betting on this being the saving grace for their kid. And oftentimes it is, you know. But yeah, so I think as a desegregation plan, though,
as a desegregation plan, it's solid, and so is busing. The question is, would there ever be a political will to make it happen? And I don't see that happening. I think there's other great desegregation plans, like living wage is a desegregation plan. Universal health care is a desegregation plan. Having people not have to, you know, carry a yoke of student debt for 40 years is a desegregation plan. There's you know, free college is a desegregation plan. There's other ways where we can actually bring people together and integrate the societies more. People in cities know this, and yet cities can also be the most diverse and the most segregated areas. But just having a random test given to a four-year-old is not going to be a fair grouping for any children, and there's going to be a lot of kids more on their game by the time they're six or seven who will be deprived of this opportunity.
And just my last question is, what do we say to the conservatives, right? The argument that, like, that they made in the National Review, which is that gifted students also have special needs and that they should be catered to, that, like, liberals are trying to cater to everybody else, but what about gifted students?
It's hilarious. I read that piece. It's like, I was stopped at a red light and the car next to me had rap music blasting and I had nowhere to go.
What? Okay.
They literally, the National Review headline literally calls it, in New York City, an attack on programs.
Yeah.
An attack on programs for gifted students. All the panel said was, hey, you want to make it better? Don't do it this way.
Right.
And Bill de Blasio was like, ooh, that's too harsh for me. And they're saying, it's an attack. So again, I go for who's offended by this, whether it's climate change or school reform.
Yeah.
And then say, oh, okay, I want to hear more.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the problem? How are we hurting the gifted students by taking away their, what do we, let them tell us, I guess.
Yeah, let them tell us exactly how.
Exactly what, I feel like what their concerns are.
They're
going to
be put in classes with the wrong elements.
I mean, that's not.
So anecdotally, this columnist was saying that mm-hmm. the gifted kids will get bored.
Oh, will they?
Oh, wow.
I mean, you know,
they will get bored.
I don't think 5 and 6 year olds are getting bored necessarily. I don't, you know, again, it's not about removing these programs. It's about making the metrics make sense.
Right. Yeah.
And
it's more of a mix.
And
also,
the other thing is, you know, in some districts, not everyone gets tested. That's like, true. I don't even know why I was tested.
Right.
Right. Because not all, everybody. So you sign up or you opt in. Or whatever, right? And so,
you have to be.
So you have to be in the know.
You have to be in the know.
Exactly.
And that is that's
already
a huge
problem. So there's so many simple fixes that don't even threaten any program.
Right.
Just like one of them is just test everyone uniformly. That's
right.
One there weird solution.
But at which age?
Right, but at which age?
And is it only one test, or do you do it again? What if your kid gets dumber as he gets older? That happens all the time.
I think there should be more than one test. The idea that your fate is sealed at, you know, I was not a great student until I was 8 years old. Like, okay. First grade, I was not a great student. That's what it was. First grade, I was not a great student. And then we moved, and then I had some sort of, like, personal revelation.
Sure.
And then I became an excellent student.
Well,
I think kids change.
I don't plan on having any kids, but if, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise, I will not have any children. But I had already planned on
as
it stays low, ankle deep. But I think I'm just going to tell anyone who has a kid to use the, like, Hollywood way of telling if your kid is smart. You know, like, is your kid doing very elaborate math problems on the wall with a crayon? Probably smart. Get that test.
A Goodwill Hunting thing.
Are they hanging out with jazz musicians and memorizing? That's a Little Man Tate way.
That's very good.
Like, how are they doing it? They got to do it a Hollywood way, or else I'm not really going to notice if they're smart or not.
Yeah, true.
And I don't know if I will ever be in some sort of position where someone's going to go, your kid's smart, because, you know, my kid is going to be on some level black. so they may miss them. They may miss them.
Yeah, it's possible. Historically speaking. Yes.
They've forgotten sometimes.
When we found out we were going to have a child, I prayed. I said, God, I don't care if it's a boy or a girl. Just please let it be able to write code. That's all I, that's,
you know,
that's aspirational. I want the best for him.
All right, you guys. I think we now, all the parents need is the movie test. And you guys, and that's it. That's all you need to be able to, like, effectively raise a child.
Compare
your child to the children you've seen in movies.
To Goodwill Hunting and to Little Man Tate. And then you're good.
And opt more for Tate than Goodwill Hunting. That guy was a mess. You don't want that
He hung out with Ben Affleck.
You don't want to do that. They just talked about apples.
All right, you guys, let us move on to our final topic, topic number three. 50 years ago, a bunch of youngins gathered at Woodstock to listen to music, to stick it to the man, and to not wear shirts or sunscreen. They were a part of a generation-defining moment, and this year is the 50th anniversary. I want to first ask by, like, do you guys, both not having, all three of us were not there, feel like some kind of nostalgia for this thing we were not around for? Like, what are your feelings about Woodstock as, like, historically?
Well, I don't really get the Woodstock generation talk, because the generation didn't all get to go to Yasgur's farm. It was a few thousand people out of millions and millions of young people. And I don't really trust these little cultural moments that then get applied to thousands of people. I mean, the Woodstock generation, what about those who were in the military? What about those who were going to grad school at the time? What about those who didn't care about music? They don't speak for the whole generation. It spoke for young people who were really into music of the era and went there. You know, I go to tons of concerts and tons of music fests, and, you know, music fans are wonderful. They are not a sampling of the rest of their entire demographic of a culture. Woodstock's great. They keep trying to replicate it. There's the proof. They keep trying to have it come back every year, and they can't do it. The thing about it is that it's also overrated. The Grateful Dead gave a terrible performance. The band did not have a good night at Woodstock. Hendrix did good, but not everyone had a good show. Richie Havens was great. Didn't give him a huge career. I mean, we can talk about the music all day, because at the end of the day, that's all it was. It was people going to hear a ton of live music for a few days. And somehow it's been fetishized by those who weren't there and those who weren't having the sex and having the drugs into being this incredibly wonderful thing, when in reality, it was filthy, it was gross, the acts were uneven, and people probably had fun. It was a nightmare getting there, Joni Mitchell couldn't even get there, so she wrote a song because she couldn't make it. It was so hard to get there. It's not an adequate sampling. It would be like if we did Lollapalooza as, you know, the marker for an entire generation.
Which it is.
Well, not for everybody. Not for Paul Ryan.
It says something about the 90s.
Yeah. So, I dig it, but it's at the same time, and it was quite a summer. I mean, it was the summer of Neil Armstrong and walking on the moon, and Ho Chi Minh died. A lot of things happened in summer of 69. But you know, we have the need to take these incidents and attach much more cultural significance to them than sometimes they even deserve.
Yeah.
Madonna, anyone? Love her, but really, you know, there's more talented people. It's just the culture fixates on whatever they like, whatever they choose to be emblematic of the entire society. And then the rest of us have to, like, you know, watch nostalgia, which is another way of just selling your memories back to you.
I mean, the funny thing about Woodstock for me, and just, I guess, the 60s in general, is like, you know, this like free love, like I'm dancing with my shirt off, like, you know, we're peeing wherever we can vibe about that particular cohort.
We have that in New York City all the time. We're shirtless and peeing everywhere and
yeah,
filthy.
If I could watch over some urine today. But I think the you know, and so we're supposed to think of like the baby boomers as all having gone to Woodstock.
Yeah.
And then they all sort of, but then for whatever reason, we don't carry forward the narrative about the boomers, because then they took a dramatic left turn
into
the 80s, where they became extremely materialistic and made the movie Wall Street.
But
right?
Woodstock was used by the Nixon people to try to smear the idealistic young people with empathy. You know, they'll always try to find a way to smear anyone with empathy, like they do with people who support climate change, or like they try to smear Black Lives Matter, or they'll try to smear Colin Kaepernick, or they'll try to smear people who stood up for LGBT rights. And Woodstock was used, as much as it was used to like sell people stuff, it was also used by the ones who loved the war in Vietnam and its prophets to smear anyone who opposed it as
right.
being a libertine who wasn't a serious person,
right.
who was indulging
touch,
in sex and
yeah.
drugs. And
self-absorbed.
And it's another yeah. way that was used to condemn young people. And look, I love that generation. I give Crosby, Stills, and Nash credit for helping end a war. So there was a lot of good attached to it. There was a lot of self-indulgence attached to it. But it's really, I think, just become a marketing tool, either against empathy or to sell you your memories back.
Do you have any nostalgia for that thing?
Not at all.
Oh,
because,
interesting.
Because it was not what was in my house growing up. There was no reverence for Woodstock.
Mine neither.
In my house. So I knew it was a thing that existed. And I'm a big music person. So really, most of my Woodstock information came from working in like an indie record store and having to listen to people go on and on and on about Woodstock and go, okay, so it was an outdoor music festival. I don't do those too much, but fine. You know, and but it was mostly music I didn't really listen to. And when I would go back in eras to listen to music, it wasn't necessarily what popped up for me personally.
Mm.
I'm sure I can see the marketing. All I've seen is the marketing aspect of it.
From afterwards. Right.
Yeah.
And because of that, that's also all I've seen with any of a big festival that's trying to be a cultural moment. Like, I get it. I see what you're doing. And for the people that you're speaking for, that's cool. I am unfortunately too cynical to buy into it. But I will come to this particular show because you've got A Tribe Called Quest and The Breeders. I will go to that
right.
one. But I'm not going to get a tattoo of whatever, or it doesn't necessarily define me.
Right.
And you know, and for people who need it to define them, let it define them, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't understand why we keep trying to.
But it is very few, because again, it didn't carry through to the next decade.
Well, I don't think they thought that through. I think it was. I think sometimes it's a little sweaty to even compare, even though I understand it's still that generation that then made it through the 70s somehow and then got to the 80s and they were like, we're making money or whatever,
yeah.
shoulder pads and
but isn't
the like.
That, but isn't that stereotyping them as well? Because, I used to feel like, oh, and they all became yuppies, but they didn't.
But
I mean, these people created Amnesty International and they created computers.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I didn't know that was how it was looked at. To me, it was just the dudes who came in and were constantly talking about the music aspect of it. I only paid attention to the music aspect of it if I thought about it at all,
Some of these young people became sellouts, and some of them led the anti-apartheid movement in America in the
80s. Which, I mean, that's just, you know, that's going to happen
And can I just say about the, I guess, the type of festival that it was, some, the idea of this, the sort of, it was organized, but the spontaneity of it was that, you know, several thousand more people came, and then they stopped even looking at tickets, right? Letting people in, which, by the way,
which, I mean, is chaos.
Farmers lost their crops, their yield that year. I mean, it was, like, actually terrible for a lot of people.
Yeah. But,
I think the idea of this kind of, like, spontaneous, I think what is interesting is the idea of this kind of spontaneous civic movement happening at the same time.
Yes.
Even if it's just for fun, right? Mm-hmm. Like that there was that so many thousands of people felt moved to do something together. It doesn't, I mean, right, things the way they are now feel very planned, you know, like,
Me too. I mean, you know, like there's, yeah. I mean, I think that's
true.
Another
yeah.
Kind
I mean,
of
like the, there, those kinds of movements are happening all the time. They just don't have a centralized location necessarily, or the location is the internet. So it's just happening
and
in
I guess
different
that,
ways.
For
and
me,
it may,
that's the nostalgia, is because when the location is the internet, I find that sad and terrible.
Yeah.
But the people who are doing it love it. And they probably look back on the memes of 4 years ago and go, remember
wasn't that,
that
amazing when there was Woodstock 55 and we all watched it live stream from our dorm rooms? Oh, I'll never forget those memories.
Right.
I took the brown acid with my roommate and, well, didn't see anybody else, but that was communal.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's, you know, that's part of it. I personally, that's how I absorb everything, is through a TV screen.
I'm not going
out much. I break out in the sun. I got issues. So I'm not going to, like, really just be all up in the mix.
I mean, there's a couple of things. I mean, obviously, Coachella and festivals like that are really, like,
but those are elitist
corporate
festivals.
Those
are elite.
They're
a lot of
really
money.
Corporate. They're really, you
that's
know, they're
Max
not.
That's not Max Yasker's farm. That's an anti-choice billionaire putting up the front money for
and
it.
And even when that started, I remember when Coachella started and it still was a little more, but it still didn't feel as free lovey as Woodstock did. And that's because Woodstock had like 25 years of press to build
that.
It's like, we're gonna do it like this, and it's gonna be, you know, we're gonna be like the festivals that happen over in England all the time. We're gonna be out here, we're all gonna be camping. Remember, it was, you know, all of that. But it was like, yeah, but you're trying to build it to an ideal that has had 25 years to build lore.
Yeah.
But for me, like on a spiritual level, what I always appreciated about Woodstock was that it was clearly devoted to the arcane Christ, Judeo-Christian concept of peace and love. And I would love to have more concerts with lots of top tier stars all in the service of peace and love. I think those ideas are as radical and as threatening to the patriarchy, oligarchy, whatever kind of, you know, bad guy you want to assign to it. And I like talking about the music and the quality of the music. I mean, on one level, yeah, this cultural movement, but on another level, I mean, Hendrix was great, not as great as Monterey, but he gave a great set. You know, I am actually, it's a bit awkward for me because I've been celebrating the 25th anniversary of Woodstock 25, not as popular as the 50th anniversary.
That was the...
That was 94.
That was the mud.
No, that was not...
Was when they burned it down.
Yeah,
94 was Green Day and the mud.
And
I
Bob
remember
Dylan
that.
Finally showed up in 94 and gave a beautiful set that was just incredible, that you know, really kept it alive and reminded people why Bob Dylan was good in the first place, because he was off in Woodstock living there. We were raising kids when the first Woodstock happened. But I really kind of felt sad that all of these media lookbacks weren't looking at, you know, why was Joe Cocker special? Why who was Richie Havens? I mean, a black man with a solo guitar opened Woodstock. I saw him live several times, but his name is almost forgotten unless you're a classic rock fan. So
yeah.
I kind of feel bad that we talk about the festival as like this big sweeping thing and not actually what it was, which was artists making music fans happy.
And that's because they had the time to build
this. There is something I feel like that happens now I actually don't even know. I'm sure it still happens. Burning Man, right? Does Burning Man still happen?
Burning Man still happens. Yeah, I forget that it does, but it does.
Grover Norquist ruined that.
And there's it is like a laissez-faire kind of ridiculous, you know, you can dress up as a penguin and that's your thing for the week or whatever it is, right?
But like anything that's been around that long that has that much recognition, which is a thing that Woodstock, is the ballad of Woodstock has been around for a long time. The actual show, just the one time. But with Burning Man, that event happening so much, and same with Coachella, whatever, it moves from being this one-time
this
moment that we all
thing,
and now it's like, oh, I got a Kickstarter because I'm trying to build a thing to take out the Burning Man. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like people are trying
to top
themselves.
Like some sponsored
and there's some, there's
shenanigans.
For sure, Red Bull was there. Willing to bet for sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and so like it. We've changed as a people.
And
so
we
have Woodstock was our ideal of what was. That's how it's always felt to me. At this time, we were real good. Remember when we were good, we all got together on a farm. And I was like, yeah, I feel like that in that year, there were other things going on in the country that were not as good. And those were the things that I heard about.
But in fairness, those were the people who were protesting that war. And that's why the power system wanted to demonize them and make them seem like superficial, spoiled, entitled kids with sex and drugs. I mean, what was it? 20 odd years after that, when I was a kid, I was a marshal for the Nelson Mandela Welcoming Committee in 1990. And to me, being in Yankee Stadium, working that rally, that was my Woodstock. Having, you know, Tracy Chapman and all these artists come out to perform and Mandela himself there in a stadium full of people cheering. And it's really the same spirit. It's about what you've all assembled there and what kind of love is uniting you and what kind of dream of a better, more loving world brought you there. And that's what separates an event like that from an event like Woodstock 99, where you have fucking Limp Bizkit just singing Break Shit and Kid Rock singing Balls in Your Mouth and people setting towers on fire during a Chili Peppers set. I mean, that's toxic masculinity. And it's like, we're all rooting for one or the other, Woodstock 99 or Woodstock 69, to ultimately be the country we live in.
I don't want the 69. Personally, I don't want the 69 version of the country.
Well, I'm saying, but do you want the peace and love version, or do you want the break shit and be a toxic masculine? You know?
I can only say it. I feel like I know more about the toxic masculinity because I've been in that longer than I have, what I have been told what 69 was like. Now, granted, I had some hardcore pro-black parents. I come from a pan-African background.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just kind of like, yeah, I get the peace and love part, but it wasn't like that for everyone. The 99, I by then knew enough to be like, no, I'm not going to go where a bunch of white folks are going to sit around and break stuff. They have a song called Break Stuff. I'm not doing that.
Mosh pits.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Mosh pits. I saw a girl break her arm in a Juliana Hatfield mosh pit. What was she listening to? Do you know what I mean? At that point, I was just like, y'all are going wild. And this is on, I don't understand it. And so I don't know about, I mean, I guess there are collective moments. And I appreciate you saying that you're working that Nelson Mandela thing was your Woodstock. I understand the importance for collective moments. But there's also building your own Woodstock, basically your own times where you're like, this is important to me. This is a thing that you know what I mean? And it can come from not even a joyous thing. It can be a moment. I remember when like a few years ago with the Eric Garner thing and they had announced that they had acquitted the policeman, and I just walked out into the street, into a rally, and we just, you know what I mean? That was a moment where I was like, I truly don't know what to do at this point, and I just need to be around people who also feel as upset and lost as I do.
You're right. In many ways, all the Iraq war protests
I
feel like those
just
are
like
my
those
Woodstock.
Kinds of,
so 2004,
if we're talking
for
like the social issue part of it.
The social issue part of it, but also the sheer number of people that were out on the streets.
Yeah, and it's always the same. People come out for a universal empathetic and moral reason who will be demonized by the power structure for being anti-American.
Yeah.
And it happens every time. And it's all aspirational. What is the intent? What is the spirit of the gathering? If it is just to be aggressive and break shit, then you can have it. If you're getting together, I don't care if I like the music or not. If it's people of goodwill coming together to have a good time, absolutely. Party your ass off, make love, do drugs, whatever your thing is, dance around naked. But if it's also in the spirit of love and anti-violence and anti-oppression and anti-war, I think we need more of that. And I think grown-ups need to start going to it more than kids.
That, I totally agree with that. Grown-ups, we're part of the solution.
Yeah.
We can be.
At this point, going to Woodstock is like privilege if you have a kid.
Oh, yeah, totally. All right, you guys. Thanks for walking down that memory lane with me of a memory none of us have.
Three people who weren't alive talking about it.
Yeah. all right. Well, there's also readers. There's a great piece in Vox that basically talks about the myth of the Woodstock generation. So that's what inspired this segment. So check that out. That is the end of the show. We always ask at the end of shows, how do you feel?
I feel all right. I feel pretty good.
Okay, great.
Yeah, yeah. Overall, I've worked hard to get to a level of
Okay.
There we go. Yeah, for me, it's a constant battle of balancing out the batshit and the dead inside. You know, like there's days when I'm too batshit and I need to bring up the dead inside. Other days where I'm so dead inside, I need some anxiety to wake myself up. Let me get some batshit in there. So that's really the best I hope for now is a balance.
I feel like you struck a really good balance today.
Thank you, Nikki. Yeah. The part of me that's dead inside doesn't care, but the part of me that's anxious will take your modest praise.
You guys, I would love for the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the amazing things that you do. Shalewa, where do they do that?
I am on all of the social media type things, your Twitter, your Instagram, your Venmo, at Silky Jumbo, all one word, traditional spelling. Silky Jumbo.
Silky Jumbo. And then remind them of your album.
My album is called So You Just Out Here. And it's on all the things that you can listen to things on or download, or I don't even know if people want to own anything anymore. I hope you do.
Own it.
I would like you to. Of course, there are no physical copies, but digitally I'd love you to own me. My ancestors are not happy that I just said that, but trust me, I do mean it from a good place. But yeah, and that's out and I'm happy about that. And that's pretty much all I'm talking about.
I'm on all the socials, on the Insta and Facebook and Twitter, John Fugelsang. Good luck spelling that. I do a daily show on Sirius XM Insight. And through September 21st, I'm going to be headlining Laughing Liberally off-Broadway with a different lineup of talented and hilarious satirists and political comedians every night, including Nagin Farsad. We've also got Marina Franklin, who was in Trainwreck and is just wonderful. Elaine Boozler is coming out of retirement, doing four shows with us.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Janine Garofalo, Ted Alexandro, Judah Friedland. Lander, a different
Mike Kaplan. Also, by the way, many of these names are veterans of Fake the Nation.
They are. A lot of people from your show and my show.
So you guys are specifically the people who will love going to this show. You should definitely go.
Yeah, it's been really, really fun. And to have Nagin Farsad back on stage working with me is a special treat.
Special treat. You guys know where to find me. I'm doing the New American Festival next week-ish. Look it up on my website. I would love to see you guys there. It's also, I think, a show that the Fake the Nation audience would love. Oh, and please check out my new column in the Progressive Magazine. My column's called Hemming and Hawing. And this month I talk about our never-ending tensions with Iran and how annoying that is and the playbook for how they turn out every time. So check that out and please share with your peeps. But what I really want to do is thank the production team here at Fake the Nation. That's our producer, Harry Nelson, our talented audio engineer, Andy Christens, Gabi Alter wrote our theme music, Lily Fleshler helps with research, and you guys, we love to hear from you. Please send us your feedback on topics we should be chatting about, guests we should have. You can leave us a voicemail at 347-770-4981. You can drop us a line at comments@fakethenation.com. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts because it helps people find the show, that's a real thing, you guys. All right. We'll be back next week in your earballs. Goodbye.